Does that take you back to your younger days?
I think for people of my generation who first heard that in about 1964, it still sends a shiver down the spine. It did then and it does now. And really interesting, as you say, that the first line picks up the end of the song, because a number of people translating the song want to translate that last verse as, "My only companion is darkness. The one friend I have left is darkness." So, yeah, it does resonate.
One of the reasons I chose it was that when I was reading through Paul Simon's own account of writing it sometime later on, he said it was all about post-adolescent angst and being in cities. And I remember distinctly going and being a student in London and age 19 and trying to cross the Euston Road and getting stuck in the middle of it with traffic whizzing past and really noisy and having a real sense of inner silence and isolation and depressive feelings. And that song particularly spoke to me. And in some ways, I guess the Psalms, like great singer-songwriters who've got that ability to connect with the human condition, can really speak to us about what humanity is like.
Yes. Interesting that in the song, silence is so to speak, a bad thing. Sorry.
I'm not sure what's happening, but there's a loose wire.
Possibly. Let's try again. Silence is not a good thing. It's an evil almost, because the silence there is the silence of voices that ought to be heard and can't be. And that connects back in its own way with the psalm, because sometimes we don't allow the voice of grief or protest to be heard. I mean, we've all witnessed and reflected on the silencing of the voices of the abused. We think not enough of the voices of the forgotten of the world, the poor, those living with year after year after year of civil war and butchery. And the silence, I think, of the song is the silence of those things not being heard. And that's where the liberation of the psalm, in a strange way, is just back to where I started, the license to say it, to name the truth of the human condition.
One aspect of the human condition, I guess, that we're very conscious of these days is depression, and Psalm 88 has been described as a depressive psalm. Paul Simon's songwriting has sometimes been called depressive, and we see this in very negative terms. But do you see connections between religion and depression?
Yes. Well, some psychiatrists talk about the depressive position as being where we all really need to get, in the sense that, in the rather technical sense, that the depressive position is where you actually accept your limitation, where you know you can't do everything. You have come to a point where you see that your own fragility, your own weakness, is just a given. And that it doesn't kill you. In a strange way, that depressive position is good news. I think religion has a lot to do with the depressive position, because it's an acknowledgement of the possibility and the limit of human endeavour, human hope. It's, how would you put it? It's a genuinely compassionate and hopeful realism. And I think that is where we all pray to get. Well, I hope we do.
So it can be part of our spiritual journey.
Yes, yes. That's not to say that, you know, depression is good for you. It's not to say for those who suffer the horrors of clinical depression, again, it's all right, really, or this is all very spiritual, so you needn't panic. It is to say that the moments when we are most up against our limits are potentially moments of growth and truth. Now, how those moments come to be genuinely moments of growth and truth, that depends on any number of things, on compassionate care, on accompaniment, on listening ears, and all the rest of it. But I think that's what it comes to. I like to think here of a book written by a great friend of mine a few years ago, Gwyneth Lewis, who was the first national poet of Wales, wrote a book called Sunbathing in the Rain, a cheerful book about depression. And essentially what she was writing about was her own experience as a clinical depressive who'd suffered enormously of trying to come to terms with these aspects of growth and truth in what she was enduring.
It's a good book to read. I know her work well from other sources, and there does take you into amazing depths. We've had a cover quite a bit of territory, and it's been a long day for you, but can I just ask you one final question? Is there something you'd like to leave us with, a take-home message about Psalm 88?
Don't know about take-home messages, yeah. But the take-home message, in a sense, is the silence at the end of the psalm. It's inviting us to say, yes, this is the truth, but yes, I can say it. And in that freedom to say it, mysteriously, you see the little brazier burning in the dark doorway. You remember the story about Russia under Stalin in the 30s and the great poet Anna Akhmatova standing in a queue of people going to visit their relatives in prison in the bitter cold of a Moscow winter. And one of the other women queuing up to visit a son or a husband, knowing who Akhmatova was, turns to her and says, "Can you write about this?" And Akhmatova says she thought about it, and she said, "Yes." And the woman said, "That's all right then." And that gift of being able to say it is somehow the beginning of a kind of grace, but we don't rush it.
Thank you.